Gender is probably the most important defining aspect of who we are as individuals. Please explain, over these next 2 weeks, we're going to explore what it means to be a boy and then what it means to be a girl. And joining me now to talk about the brains, the growth and development, and the needs of boys are Dr. Margaret McCarthy, a professor of physiology and associate dean of psychiatry at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. Her research focuses on the influence of hormones on the developing brain. And Dr. Michael Thompson, he's a psychologist specializing in children and families and co-author with Dan Kindlin of the New York Times bestseller Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys. Some of his other books are Speaking of Boys, Answers to the Most Asked Questions About Raising Sons, and It's a Boy, Your Son's Development from Birth to Age 18. All of those are published by Ballantine Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Drs. McCarthy and Thompson to our show today. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Leonard.
And let's begin with you, Peg McCarthy. We often begin these Please Explain segments with the absolute basics. Are there significant differences between the brains of boys and the brains of girls?
Well, we know that there are very profound sex differences in the brains of animals, ranging from lizards up through dogs, cats, rats, mice, birds, and primates. And we see the similar types of differences in human brains, only they do tend to be generally of a smaller magnitude than what we see in animal brains. But that's a long way of saying, yes, there are differences in boys' and girls' brains.
And when does this start? At the very beginning of the fetus?
No, not the very beginning. We call a sensitive period of development, during which this occurs. In the human, it's predominantly in utero. And what a lot of people don't realize is that a developing fetus, a developing baby, actually has a full set of gonads that are capable of making hormones, just like we see happening in a pubertal teenager. So a newborn human male has the circulating testosterone of a 25-year-old adult, and that's coming from his own testis. And this is after he's already got all his male accoutrements. And as far as we know, the main purpose of this late synthesis of testosterone in pregnancy is for that testosterone to act on his brain to change his brain phenotype to match his gonadal phenotype, you might say.
So this is called masculinizing the brain?
Correct.
And that only happens with males?
Well, so the corollary to that, of course, is feminizing the brain. But sort of the way Mother Nature designed it is that the brain is set on a default pathway towards the female, and that in the absence of this exposure to testosterone during this sensitive developmental window, it will develop as a female. And what makes it becomes a male is on the Y chromosome, you have a single gene called the sex-determining region of the Y chromosome, and it codes for a single protein called testis-determining factor. And that protein is going to make sure that the gonad becomes a testis. If that protein isn't expressed, the gonad will become an ovary. Very similarly, the brain sort of starts out with the capability of becoming female, which is where it's headed. But if the gonad has become a testis and makes testosterone, then the brain will differentiate towards the male.
So this is kind of like a red light, green light situation.
Well, you could think of it that way, except for that's an oversimplification of the reality, which is that there's no such thing as a purely male brain and purely female brain. They're really quite heterogeneous throughout, and that there's some portions of the brain that could be more male and more female within one individual of either sex. So I think it's a little misleading to sort of say male brain versus female brain. But there are certainly male characteristics which are going to be more predominant in the brains of boys versus girls.
Michael Thompson, people who have children, especially if they have a boy and a girl, often feel intuitively that there are tremendous differences between them right from birth. I know this is an almost impossible question to answer, but what's understood about how our responses to boy babies shape their boyness?
Well, we all have a response to the male body, and a baby who has a penis means a parent has a lot of expectations and hopes and fears about it. I actually think that in early infancy, the most important thing is the temperament of the child. Is the child a good sleeper? Is the child easily aroused? Is the, temperament and style of baby is most important in the early going, not gender. But gender grows in importance. So much of what you call the boyness, the reaction to the boyness, is what the mother and father themselves bring to it. And you know that when if people pick up a baby, and this has all been researched, but it's obvious as well. You know, they pick up a little girl and say, isn't she sweet? Isn't she beautiful? And then a boy, isn't he handsome? You know, he's a big, what a strong-looking boy.
Well, is that something that's registering?
What?
Is that registering with the infant?
No. That's just the parents entertaining themselves with their notions of what boy and girl are.
Because a listener from Kate, from New York, who is the mother of fraternal twins, a boy and a girl, a new mother of them, she said, I'm a longtime believer that many of the behaviors of boys and girls are socially taught.
Right.
Though how much of that is true? She said, I see differences in my children's behavior now, even at 9 weeks, but I figured that it's just simple personality differences that could easily be seen between two girls.
Well, see, she's only got an experiment of two children. Not of 2,000 boys and girls. There's a wide variability in human temperament, but there also are, on average, gender differences. And those begin to emerge as children grow up. And so boys, as they grow older, seem to be more boy, and girls seem to be more girl. And it's because of certain predispositions in the brain are brought out by social experience, by parental expectations, by the kind of play that children engage in. So girls, when they start to play around 3 years old in gender-exclusive groups, girls tend to pull back from the boys and say they play too rough, and they start to play on their own. And boys tend to play on their own. And at that point, they get much more recognizably boy, and they develop really boy and girl play patterns.
And that's what leads to that insulting rhyme, I thought, anyway, when I was a kid. Boys are snips and snails and puppy dog tails, and girls are sugar and spice and everything nice.
Right.
I thought we were getting a bad rap.
Well, we do. But we tend to play rougher, too, Leonard.
My guests are Dr. Michael Thompson, whose latest book, written with Dan Kinlan, is Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys. And Dr. Margaret McCarthy, professor of physiology and associate dean of psychiatry at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Peg, can you tell us how differences in the structure of the male brain may be responsible for some of the things that we think of as classic boy behavior?
Well, when we say classic boy behavior, as Dr. Thompson just said, as though, you know, rough and tumble play is a good example. If we look at boys across the whole, males across the whole animal spectrum, that's a very, very reliable and robustly sexually dimorphic behavior. And we know that there's certain regions of the brain, such as the amygdala, that are important to this difference. And the differences that we see are the way the neurons connect to each other and how many neurons there might be in that particular region. And we know that that early hormonal exposure can have that impact on this number of neurons and the way they make their synaptic connections. But we also know that things like play and aggression, which is also boy typical, are really controlled in multiple sites in the brain throughout a complex network of areas. So we can't point to a area in the brain that makes you a bully, say, or makes you want to climb trees or something of that sort.
Would having more testosterone in your system make you more of a bully or more likely to want to climb trees?
Yes, I would say it most definitely does. And we know that's true in humans as well as across the animal kingdom. And even just, you know, if we look at aggression in animals that are seasonal, you know, animals are only aggressive during their reproductive part of the year because that's when their testosterone is high. And so that's when the males all try to beat each other up. And then later on when their testosterone goes down, all the males are good buddies and they all hang out in the herd together because it's much safer for them to be together in a group. So there certainly is an immediate effect of hormones on behavior. But a lot of what's happening in boys or in juvenile animals is actually independent of the hormones because it's what we call organized earlier in life. So, you know, a 5-year-old boy doesn't have testosterone. Even a 7-year-old boy doesn't have any testosterone. But he sure still shows this male-like behavior from the testosterone exposure earlier on that has sort of wired, as you might, his brain to favor these kinds of behaviors.
How much of the wiring is responsible for the things that we see not only in humans but all primates, that boys are more likely to pick up a toy with wheels or something that moves, and girls tend to like plush toys and squishy things?
Right. Well, that's what I was going to answer to sort of the question from the person who emailed in with the mother of twins, is that certainly culture plays a huge role in the behavior of boys and girls. But if we look at monkeys and we give them a choice of toys to play with that they've never seen before and certainly their parents have had no influence on, we can see that the boy monkeys all want things that move and make noise and that they can bang on the ground, and the girls pick up the soft things and they, you know, hold them softly and stuff. So there is something in their brains that's biological that makes them choose, have a preference for these kinds of inanimate objects. Where in the brain is the choice of a truck versus a doll? I wish we knew. We really aren't sophisticated enough yet to be able to pinpoint where in the brain that's happening.
What about the
can I just jump
sure.
in and say I don't want people to take away the idea that there's a sort of a direct one-on-one. You have a little shot of testosterone, you hit somebody. You know, Tremblay.
It works with me.
Yeah, Tremblay in Montreal. Studied boys from kindergarten into adolescence, and he found his group of high fighters who were always having trouble in school and were always getting into fights, when they went into adolescence, had lower levels of testosterone than his social leaders who didn't have who didn't fight in school. So there isn't this we can't pin it down. I think Peg's been saying there isn't a structure in the brain we can point to. These things are mediated socially. Maybe being a social success with other boys gives you higher testosterone.
Indeed, and I applaud your clarification of that. There is no one-to-one relationship. Hormones are powerful modulators, and they modulate against a background of experience, of genetics, of, you know, all sorts of various things. And certainly I would never want to give the impression that testosterone makes you into a bully, but it does contribute to a whole cohort of behaviors that include aggression and leadership and risk-taking. And, you know, there's good and bad and all this whole cohort of behaviors that we associate with sort of maleness, yet many, many females will show those same traits. And that's the other point, is that it's not testosterone equals male either.
Well, all of those conventional wisdoms don't apply 100%, but there is conventional wisdom that boys are better at solving spatial problems, girls are quick to read or adapt socially. I was probably quicker to read than to solve spatial problems.
So I'll speak to that in terms of that. There's a wonderful scientist, Elizabeth Spelke at Harvard, who did a kind of an interesting expose on this topic after the Lawrence Summers fiasco of a few years ago. And she's going to give a talk on that at the Society for Neuroscience meetings in Chicago this year. And a lot of our perceptions about these cognitive biases in humans are really also biases that we have societally. A lot of the tests that we use have inherent biases in them towards solving problems in particular ways. And if you switch the way that a problem is solved, you can actually reverse the sex difference between boys and girls. It's also how stressful you make the testing situation has a huge impact on the outcome of boys and girls. And one thing that does seem to be coming out fairly consistently is that girls are more subject to sort of test anxiety. And if the situation is made more stressful, their performance will decrease, whereas males will increase. But if the test situation is not stressful, performance can be quite equalized or even reversed. It's also when it comes to, like, the math SATs, we all know, oh, you know, the boys score higher than the girls. And that is true in this country. That is not true in Japan. Their boys and girls score equally, and they both score a lot better than American kids. And then, interestingly, if we go to a country like Iceland, the sex difference is actually reversed, and the girls score a lot better than the boys. So we have to be very careful about making these grand assumptions based on data that itself might be inherently biased.
And, Michael, haven't you written about how our educational system, at least the one in this country, kind of discriminates against boys learning?
Well, the average boy, and I think Peg would agree with this, the average boy, his development tends to lag behind girls. That's not every boy and not every girl. But if you go to a first grade assembly in an elementary school and they've been given a song to sing, what you see is six girls who know all the words standing up front singing and one boy, and then you've got three or four boys are wandering around waving to their moms, mouthing the words. I mean, you actually can see average brain differences and average developmental differences as they operate in schools. So a school can often be, because it requires so much sitting and listening, and the elementary school classroom is four-fifths language-based, and the average boy tends to lag behind in language in the early going, school has a different impact on boys and girls. And boys routinely find it tougher to be in school, to meet the demands of school. So that as somebody who's been a school psychologist for years, I know that, two-thirds to three-quarters of the boys who sent to special education who were sent to see a psychologist, two-thirds to three-quarters of the children who are sent to see a psychologist are boys. So boys struggle much more in elementary school. And by middle school, with girls entering in earlier puberty, it's obvious the gap, because you don't have to ask a neuroscientist. You ask seventh grade girls, and what do they say every day about boys? They're so immature.
Mm-hmm. Well, where do we go wrong as parents or caregivers in raising boys? Are we making the same mistakes that our educational system is making?
I have two complaints about the way we parent boys. And one is that boys often express shame or humiliation or a sense of inadequacy in an angry way. And people unwittingly reinforce that by over-focusing on it, but they also get frightened of it. People get frightened of boys. They get frightened of boy fantasies and boy games. They think it's going to lead to adult violence. And so we tend to overreact to boys. We hit them more than we do girls. And I think people misinterpret sometimes impulsivity and activity level and intentional aggression. And that can be quite alienating for little boys. I also believe that teachers often in school say that the way the girls are is the gold standard against which all people's behavior should be measured. And three-quarters of the boys in the class are more physically active than the girls. So it's going to be, in fact, tougher for them. And I meet many teachers who really get boys and understand boys. And they may have to corral them more. They may have to make more limits and boundaries. But they convey an appreciation of what boy development is and that boys are trying to be good citizens. And boys love them. And there are other teachers who are sort of constantly disapproving, sort of are always experiencing boys as sort of disruptive of the way school should be. And that I object to.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And when we come back, I also want to talk about why boys are more vulnerable to certain neurological disorders, autism, dyslexia, ADD, stuttering, early onset schizophrenia. We will be talking with my guest, Dr. Michael Thompson, a psychologist specializing in children and families. His most recent book, It's a Boy, Your Son's Development from Birth to Age 18. He's also the co-author with Dan Kinlan of the New York Times bestseller. Was on the bestseller list for, 120 years? Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys, published by Ballantyne. And Dr. Margaret McCarthy, professor of physiology and associate dean of psychiatry at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. Her research focuses on the influence of hormones on the developing brain. Again, our number 212-433-9692. We'll be back right after this. And we're back with Please Explain with Drs. Margaret McCarthy and Michael Thompson talking about boys. Next week, we will look at girls. But it's impossible to talk about boys without comparing them to girls. And as I said earlier, boys are much more vulnerable to certain neurological disorders. I gave you a list. And girls to other ones, depression, eating disorders, and late-onset schizophrenia. Peg, do we have any idea of why?
Well, at a mechanistic level, no, we don't have any idea why, but we can sort of give a bigger picture explanation, which is, as I was saying before, the brain is set on a natural course towards the female, and it's testosterone that sort of derails it or alters it or sends it towards the male phenotype. And everything that we've been learning about at the cellular level about what that testosterone does is that it's pushing the brain, it's pushing the systems with neuronal excitation, because that's the way the brain grows. You know, it's a little bit analogous. Some people are familiar with the experiments, Nobel Prize winning experiments by Hubel and Wiesel, that if you raise a kitten in an environment that consists entirely of up and down black and white vertical bars, they can never see a horizontal bar. That's because that excitation that their eyes are putting into their brain is mapping on what they can see. And we push the brain development in that same way with electrical excitation. And that's a lot of what testosterone does. Well, whenever you're pushing a system, your ability to push it off course is at higher risk, right? And so we sort of think that's why males are at higher developmental risk disorders. And put in a very simple way, many of those male bias disorders are disorders of neuronal wiring.
And they occur fairly early in development, don't they?
Well, they're diagnosed early. I mean, autism is almost always diagnosed within, you know, 3 to 5 years of age, ADHD before 10 years of age. Stuttering comes out in childhood. And the early onset schizophrenia is just sort of peripubertal, you know, just kind of a tween age type thing as a common period of onset.
But we do see girls who are dyslexic.
Of course.
And autistic. Although I have never met an Asperger's girl. I'm sure there are some.
Oh, no, there certainly are.
Oh, yeah. Many.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so none of this is absolutes. And that's a really important thing about any discussion of differences between boys and girls, is there's, you know, as much overlap and as much commonality as there is difference. And we all like to focus on the difference because they're interesting and they are important and everything. But there's also a tremendous amount of commonality. And we're just talking relative risk. I mean, even in adulthood, we know that women are at higher risk of depression than men, but that risk is about 1.8 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's plenty of men who get depressed too.
Now, just one more thing before we get to calls. Michael, are there things that parents and caregivers can do to help protect young boys who might be predisposed to have disorders or disabilities of this sort?
Well, it's hard to protect kids against neurological disorders. But in fact, boys under 10 are quite depression prone. Boys in school get very sad and then get very mad. And it's important for people to understand that their anger and their acting out and their disruptive behavior may be the result of depressive feeling. And I think it's really important to understand what's going on behind the mask of boys, because little boys often think, I don't want to cry, I want to look tough, I want to be a man. That's what the requirements, our social requirements of masculinity, say to them. And if you can make boys safe, I consult a lot to boys' summer camps. And when we were talking about plush toys earlier, I was reminded of the fact that almost every 10 and 11-year-old or 12-year-old boy who's away from home at a boys' summer camp brings a bear with him and cherishes it and holds it. And they're on their pillows. I see them when I go to camp. So,
and then the kids make fun of them, and they don't do that again.
No, but if you get a camp that's very accepting and many, many boys, the majority of boys bring a toy from home, a plush toy, then it is accepted. You see different behaviors in boys when they feel safe and when they are in an environment that appeals to them and understands that they're boys. Again, to go back to my camp analogy, boys who I think are very restless and have attentional problems in school, you give them a knife at age 10 and ask them to whittle something or start a fire, you get highly cooperative behaviors, you get highly focused behaviors, because they think this is important to them as boys and men. And so I see great variations in these so-called ADHD problems. I know some kids suffer from truly great difficulties in focusing, but because I move between camp and school, I often see great differences that come from the context and the way boy behavior is interpreted.
Well, let's take a call. Annette from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. At what point does homosexuality manifest itself in boys?
Peg, you want to take that?
Well, there's no easy answer to that. I mean,
some homosexuals will tell you they knew when they were very young,
right.
and others discover it when they're in their teens or even when they're older.
That's right. I mean, I would say that it's, you know, the same question as when do boys discover that they're heterosexual? It's just as variable. Some boys, you know, get an interest in the same or the opposite sex quite young, and others, it's, you know, the girls have to come and knock them on the head and say, look at me. So I don't think that there's any reason to believe that homosexual boys have any earlier awareness of their sexuality than heterosexual boys.
I do think it's when boys start developing a masturbatory life around age 12, they are having a sexual fantasy life, they do start to get information about people to whom they're attractive. I've had many gay men talk to me about discovering that they had a crush on another boy or were sexually fantasizing about another boy around 12. But many, as you say, knew they were in some way different in elementary school. And when I go to elementary schools, teachers are often talking to me about a pre-K boy or a kindergarten boy who is a regular kind of cross-dresser and wants to play always a girl's role. And the research suggests that boy is likely to turn out gay.
And do we know whether this is a hormonal thing or whether this is a wiring thing?
Well, those aren't really separable. Right, because hormones are going to affect the wiring of the brain. We have some evidence that there is higher androgen can lead to homosexuality in males, and this is by using other sort of biomarkers of androgen exposure. Yet, interestingly, one of the most reliable, robust predictors of male homosexuality is the number of older brothers. So that if you've had three or more older brothers, that your incidence of homosexuality goes up quite a bit.
Wow.
We don't think that's because you're getting beaten up by your older brothers or anything like that, because there's also a corresponding decrease in birth weight, and that you can also control for, you know, being adopted out and things. So that there's something biological going on there, but we don't know yet what it is. And certainly there are many boys with older brothers who do not become homosexual.
We got a comment on our show page from Janelle in New Jersey. She said, I've always thought I could raise my boy to be a gentle, nonviolent little person, but I learned that directing him to Maisie Mouse and kitchen toys and dolls was useless. Boys will pick up sticks in the yard to have a sword fight and pretend to shoot guns with their fingers. My girls have no interest in that type of play whatsoever. I'm finding as the years pass that nature is much more powerful than nurture. Do you agree?
Absolutely.
It's always a mix. I liked a professor of psychology on retiring said I've been grappling with this nature versus nurture question all of my life, and I've decided nature wins by 52-48%.
About 50% of the time, yeah. I mean, I think that the point is that people underestimate the power of nature, and that the thing to do is to not fight against it, but to embrace it and work with it in a positive way. Because there's also, yeah, she's right, boys will pick up sticks to make guns, and then they'll also, you know, make robots and make pretend computers and do all sorts of wonderful mechanical type of imaginary play that you can encourage. And I think that Michael put it exactly right. Don't be terrified with the fact that they make something into a toy gun that they're then going to be, you know, become a killer later on.
I have to tell teachers all the time, they ask me, what do we do about the problem of violent play with boys? And I say, well, there's no such thing as violent play. If two boys are chasing each other around, you know, with the index finger out and the thumb up, going bang, bang, bang to each other on the kindergarten playground, five-year-olds don't really understand death. They've both signed up. They're laughing. They're dropping to the ground. They're popping up. They're having fun. That's play.
Is that all that much different than when we see puppies play with each other?
I think it's very similar. Boys, the world around, play hunt and chase games and wrestle games. That's just known in every society and every religion. It's when an adult watching it thinks this is so dangerous, this can lead to violence, that's when they overreact to boys and lose credibility with boys. Now, but if a group of boys surround a second grade girl under the jungle gym and terrify her, that's intentional and aggressive and scary, and that has to be addressed. So I say, what's the intention and what's the impact? If it's hurtful, then that's aggression or violence. If it's not and it's playful, people shouldn't go nuts about it.
We go now to Kathleen from Maplewood. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have three boys. My oldest son is 11. And I've struggled year to year with different teachers and having some teachers that totally understand boys. And then I have other teachers that really just don't get it. And I wind up having a lot of problems and having it kind of come out that, your child is a problem because he can't sit still. I took away recess, all the things that make a boy because he's active. And I really don't know what to do. I mean, how do you handle this year to year when you start to think that maybe your son has a teacher that doesn't understand boys? Do you switch him out of the class? I mean, it's a problem.
Michael?
Should I take this one?
Yes, please.
It is a problem. And it's one of the reasons I go around and try and teach teachers about normal boy development is that I'm trying to get a discussion of gender and what is naturally boy and naturally girl. I want people in the school to be talking about it because there are sometimes brittle teachers, I mentioned it earlier before, who don't like boy behavior, keep wishing the boys would behave like the girls and play the same games as the girls. And when boys sense that in a teacher, they just go to war against them. If they find they have a third grade teacher who's just chronically disappointed in them, that they write her off. And at the same time, I've seen third grade boys who love their teacher, a woman who gets boys, is not freaked out by them, isn't squeamish, and, can hear a fart joke and not go ballistic. Because boys imitate fart noises more than girls.
I want to get to one other thing. Peg, we keep on changing throughout our early years. I don't know how late the changes occur, but during puberty, doesn't our brain reform?
Well, I wouldn't say it reforms, but it gets there's an additional clear sort of finishing step, you might say, or in a different additional modulation. We know that synaptogenesis is continuing in the frontal cortex until you're 21, 22 years old.
So does this keep on changing how boys will be boys and girls will be girls?
Yes, probably, and it's a recent area of study in terms of at the biological level to really appreciate how much there is an additional sort of organizational action that sort of mirrors what's happened earlier on to sort of, you might say, like really crystallize it or really finalize it. So, and we don't understand it very well yet. I mean, we all know that when somebody goes through puberty, their behavior changes amazingly, but we're just beginning to get insight into how that might really be setting the stage for an adult life of behaviorals and health that has a more permanent effect than just, whoop, now I'm through puberty.
Because we see kids who are perfectly wonderful who suddenly turn into monsters after puberty and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Do we see kids who were wonderful turn into monsters?
Serial killers?
That's what?
Like serial killers, they were kids. They were just using their finger to shoot their friend.
No, you're talking about the people who turn into killers are raised with the stress of poverty or their gangs in their neighborhood. They see that violence is rewarded. I think there are social factors. I don't think puberty turns perfectly lovely boys into killers overnight. I think they become a lot more interested in sex.
Mm. Worked that way with me anyway.
And a lot of things change. Their sleep patterns and things change. But I agree. When you use the word serial killer, that's a person who's mentally ill. That's not the result.
I was just making a bad joke there.
Right,
but I'm running out of time, unfortunately. It's been wonderful talking with the two of you on today's Please Explain. And my great thanks to Dr. Margaret McCarthy, who's a professor of physiology, associate dean of psychiatry at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, Baltimore. And with Dr. Michael Thompson, a psychologist who specializes in children and families, his latest book, It's a Boy, Your Son's Development from Birth to Age 18. His bestseller was Raising Cain. Thank you both. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
It was enjoyable.